Morgan Malone, Chief Executive of the Analytics Institute of Ireland, and you're very welcome to our podcast series, Data Leaders. In these podcasts, I chat with some of the most important and influential people in the data analytics area in Ireland, and I try to find out a little bit about the people and personalities behind the careers. I also want to explore their philosophy in relation to data and analytics in general, and also find out a little bit about where they think the industry is going in the future. I hope you enjoy this series of interviews, and if you do, please subscribe below. Thank you. So good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to our podcast series, which is the Data Leaders Series podcast. I'm Lorcan Malone. I'm the CEO of the Analytics Institute. And with me today is a very interesting man who has a long and varied career in data and in analytics, and is currently the head of insights and data science at Car Trawler, Patrick Callanan. Welcome, Patrick.
Thanks, Lorcan.
So, Patrick, this finds us on Good Friday, just before Easter, on a very nice warm day outside, and we're both stuck in our respective houses due to COVID-19. How are things in Car Trawler with the current situation?
We're actually kept very busy. So obviously demand is way, way down. So we're in the car hire business and car hire insurance business. And things will be quiet, I would say, for another month or two. But people still are booking. I think there's probably a lump of demand starting to come now for 2021, where people are looking for, you know, when this is all over, I definitely am going to need a break. Yeah. So the demand is starting to pick up a little bit again. And then, of course, you know, in the data world, the world doesn't stop just because, you know, current demand is quiet. We have a lot of analysis to do on figuring out, you know, how we prepare for the bounce, because there will be a bounce. Yeah. And there's a lot of, we're taking advantage of the time to maybe build some functionality that we wouldn't be able to do in the normal run of events. So we're doing a lot on our data science pipeline, on our models, life cycles, you know, stuff that will be useful to us later on. So busy.
Yeah, sure. I think you're right. I think there will be a bounce. I'm hoping there'll be a bounce. You kind of get two different lines of thought on this. And one is that the economy has been fundamentally wounded and is going to suffer for years. And then the more optimistic corner, which is where I am, is that I'm hoping that we'll come back on fire and that we will recoup a lot of what has been lost over the last couple of months. You guys will be one of the first, I assume, to know, won't you, given that travel is the first thing that people will want to do once they come out of the cocooning.
It is. And I think we partner with airlines and online travel agencies. So as soon as those airports reopen, even when we start seeing the route plans, so all airlines will be filing route plans with various regulatory authorities. So once we see pickups in that, we'll know that the sentiment is moving in the right direction. Once we see movements in searches, then we'll see that the consumer demand is starting to come back or people are starting to nibble. So yeah, I'm hoping that, you know, data science and insights in Car Trawler will be one of the first to know when demand is going back.
And can you tell me a little bit maybe about Car Trawler as an organization? And then maybe if you could tell me a little bit about what data you're actually working on and what you're trying to achieve from that data.
Sure. I'll start by saying I've been Car Trawler for almost exactly a year now. So I joined them around this time last year. So I won't take credit for inventing that business, but it's a really cool business. I think not a lot of people know us because we're a B2B company. So we're kind of, if you're on an airline and they offer you on their booking engine the opportunity to do car hire, a lot of the time, that's us. So, you know, we price 1 billion cars during the peak months during the day. So like, this is not a small business.
Oh, wow.
Roughly like 250, 300 million of turnover per year. So quite a substantial business. It's been around for a while. It's gone through like various evolutions. The current, business is essentially, we build transportation solutions or ancillary revenue solutions for people like airlines or online travel agencies. They're kind of relying on us because we have the relationships with the car hire suppliers. And there's a lot to, it sounds like a simple thing. So you offer someone a car, but just like every online retail business, the better that you can match what you're offering to what the consumer would actually take, then the higher conversion rates you're going to have on that.
Yeah.
And the higher satisfaction and so on. So like, there's no point in giving me a 6-seater bus if I'm flying alone. So there are, I think, a lot of long-term learnings that we have on what kind of cars to put in front of you. So one of the things that my team does is the SORT engine. So we will get probably around 300 or 400 cars from various suppliers of various sizes at various prices with various fuel policies, various insurance included, not included. So there's quite a complex decision to be made, and figuring out how to match that supply to the demand that's crossing your doorstep and crossing it really quickly. So, we are part of the booking flow for an airline or an OTA. Generally speaking, we pop up in front of you, you make your decision and you move on. So we have very little time to decide what to put in front of you and to execute on it. So I think we work very closely with our P&T department where all of this magic happens. There are servers all over the world to make this happen faster. And figuring out SORT is one of the big things that we're doing at the moment. You can always improve on that. So there's quite a large project in data science at the moment called SORT Outsort. The other kind of cool thing that we're doing at the moment is pricing. So obviously, you need to understand what you want to offer and the price you want to offer it at. You could give it away for free, but you're not going to do that. So we are taking a margin on the throughput, and it's important for us to maximize in the long term that margin. So this isn't about making money on this. We also consider the loyalty aspect. So if you get a good deal from us this time, then you'll come back and rebook through us the next time. So lifetime value is probably more important than individual transaction value. So figuring out all of those numbers and parameters and figuring out how to deliver them to what we call the OTA, which is the big engine that does all of this work in a split second. That's a large part of what we're doing on data science and data engineering. So that's one piece of the work. We have about 400 employees. All of them are pretty technical. And they need to see what's happening in their piece of the business. So we've got people who in trading who are figuring out, what kind of pricing strategy we're going to do, who we're going to offer here, what kind of marketing package we've got around, and so on. They have dashboards. We've got people in supply. They're figuring out what is the customer satisfaction with a particular supplier. Should we continue to offer those guys, or, are they getting a little bit sloppy in terms of how they take care of our customers or our customers. So we do a lot of work on customer sat. We do a lot of work on quality, and we put that all through dashboards. So we're a pretty big customer for Tableau, and we have a big, really big Snowflake warehouse at the back end. We did the migration last year from Redshift to Snowflake. That was one of the first things we got to when I came here. So we're a warehouse, and that warehouse is pretty much real time as well. So it's updating the dashboards that are in front of people who are trading this business. And it's in front of the strategy people. It's in front of the finance people. So we're essentially an information provider to the rest of the business. And figuring out how to present that data and pre-process that data so that it generates insight is another big part of it. So I guess we're raw material or unrefined insight. We also have an insights team. So we're doing a lot of work at the moment on customer journeys. So that's yet another analytics stream that's coming through. We're setting up Snowplow. So Snowplow is essentially a web tagging. So, you know, as you move through your journey through our website and through our partner's website, you will be taking certain actions. You'll be scrolling down. You'll be dwelling on a particular thing. You'll be clicking on a particular thing. So figuring out how people are going through that journey and where the pain points are and where we could, you know, do a little bit better in terms of making it smooth for them, so they don't drop off. So that's a purchase funnel analysis or, you know, an MVT funnel analysis job. And I just mentioned MVT, so that's another part of what we're doing. We do multivariate testing on, I won't say everything we do, but like a significant part of what we do. Before we roll out a significant change, we will run in parallel the champion, which is essentially what we're doing right now, and the challenger, what we're actually intending to do. And we'll see how that affects the conversion funnel all the way down, how it affects our final, what we call contribution margin or unit margin, so how much money we make. And you know, we're building some additional functionality to see how it will affect customer lifetime value. So, you know, you may go through faster, you may convert better, but you may not come back. And we may make more money, but you may not come back. So understanding how you take care of that customer through life cycle to maximize the customer lifetime value is something that we're doing quite a lot on. And that's fed by the MVT analytics, which in turn is fed by the Snowplow. So that's another piece. And then I guess, you know, last but not least, we do a lot of pretty heavy duty econometric or data science modeling. I think, you know, what people, when they hear data science, they probably think of, they're doing propensity models. Yep, we are. Or they're doing fraud models. Yep, we are. Or insurance pricing models. Yep, we are. So like a lot of models that help, I guess, apply the better techniques that are out there. Like when I started my career, you know, data science wasn't even called data science, it's called analytics or something. And way back then, regression was the safest thing to do because it worked, or logistic regression. And it's easy to execute as well. But, you know, as we went along, I kind of went into CHAID, which is the tree-based analysis. And that was really good for direct marketing. So for CRM, oh, sorry, I forgot to tell you, we do CRM too. So the analytics that helps our guys decide who to do customer relationship management emails to, we would be supporting those guys with either data or in some cases models. So we've moved on. The other interesting, and I think thing that I get to boast about it because it's my team doing it, not me. So I'm kind of the dumb suit these days, and the smart young people are the ones that are doing the good stuff. But we have a tool called ACDC that we built. And it essentially allows us to run Python, which is kind of our drug of choice. In parallel, it's actually running through a Flask framework. Sorry, might be a bit geeky here, but essentially we're making Python run in a Java environment, and that gives us the best of both worlds. So we can write in Python, we can use all of the data science libraries that are available to us in Python, but we're running them on top of a Java, very heavily Java coding plant at CareerDaughter, running it on top of a Java plant. And that means we don't have to transcode anything. So when we build a model and we do our unit tests, and we're surprisingly good. Like I'm impressed with my guys that they've become, you know, production programmers as well as data scientists. And I think all of the disciplines that you would expect out of, you know, enterprise class software, we're also doing in data science these days. So when we've built our models and when we've tested them and we know they're reliable and we've MVT'd them, so we know they're better than what we had before, then we can deploy that into production in partnership, obviously, with the people who run that plant, P&T. We can deploy them into production with pretty, like, minor changes. And that's a huge advantage. So back in my previous jobs where we might be building it in R and then someone's transcoding it to something else, a lot got lost in translation, and the kind of lift that we were seeing in the A/B testing didn't actually come through. Now you get the full benefit of the model. So we're kind of proud of that. That's kind of it.
That shouldn't keep you too busy, Pat. That's hugely complex and very demanding. I often think one of the key dynamics in an organization in dealing with data and analytics is the interface between, say, someone like yourself, the head of analytics, and the stakeholders that you're servicing or serving. And maybe you could talk to this a little bit, Patrick. I mean, how do you manage that? How do you manage expectations and ensure that you're meeting their requirements, but at the same time ensuring that you're doing so in a way that your team can be most effective? You know, so do you get demands from you that are unreasonable or impossible, or how do you manage that, and how much power do you have in making that decision about what you can do as a group and what you can't do as a group?
In fairness, Arkin, that's probably the best question I've been asked in a long time, because I think you've hit the crux of what, you know, data science and analytics needs to do within a business. It is that constant trade-off between you have a bunch of really bright people who want to hit the latest library. So, you know, like in some of my previous lives, pretty much 100% of the guys wanted to go play with TensorFlow. It's cool. You know, it's, you know, who wouldn't want to do a little bit of deep learning or neural nets or whatever? But, you know, it's not, at the time, it wasn't particularly deployable. So that tension between ensuring that your guys have, you know, we call it 15% for research. So that's my deal with my team. We try to make it so that 15% of the time we're working on cool stuff that we are interested in, even if there's no possibility of a payoff. So we kind of hive off that time, and that's our R&D time, and no one gets to touch it. And you know, it's unofficial. I'm sure if my boss is listening to this podcast at some stage, he'd be very surprised to know that there's 15% overhead here. But it's not really overhead. When people are given the opportunity, and that really translates to, hey, one Friday every 3 weeks, go hide. You know, I'm not going to come looking for you, and I'm going to tell people that you're working on something for me. Go hide and work on something cool and interesting that we need to get into. So, you know, I mean, the ACDC that I mentioned earlier, that came from that kind of, you know, speculative R&D work. I wonder if we could make this work.
Okay.
And the guys went and did it. So that's number one. The flip side is, yes, obviously we got our 15% for research, but we have to pay our taxes.
Yeah.
And you know, that those are the words I use with the team. So, you know, we do pay our taxes, and we figure out in conjunction with the stakeholders, you know, show me the money. So the ACDC project that I mentioned and the rope insurance models that run on top of it, they are very important to the business, and everyone understands that they're very important to the business, and we've quantified it, and it will pay for the team multiple times over. It's also very helpful with valuation. We're owned by private equity, so they're always interested in, you know, what will the exit be? Will they float us? Will they sell us?
Yeah.
So, you know, a company that's creating really genuinely money-making IP that can prove it, it's a valid use of our time. So I think my stakeholders are the COO, because he's the guy I work for, so chief operations officer. That means kind of two things. One, the rest of the business needs to run smoothly. And to the extent that insights, data science, and data intelligence can make that happen, then that's the job. It's kind of led us into kind of really interesting and strange corners, because then we'll take a look at all of the demand and we'll figure out what is the highest long-term benefit for the company. We'll put a valuation on it, and that's the one we work on. And then we just kind of push away the other demand. So the I guess the stakeholder management is essentially where will we get the biggest bang for the buck from the team, then that's where we're going to focus it. So that's why you see us building ACDC, which, it, you know, it's really cool, but it's also a way of having the same number of data scientists maintain about twice as many models, and all of these models make money.
Yeah.
So like our ROI per headcount is going to be double what it was. And that alone, you know, pays for this project. Same deal. We do a lot of customer care at CarTrawler. So, you know, if you have some questions on your car rental, you know, you will be calling us. So we've got call centers. We've got several call centers. The call center analytics piece is equally interesting to CarTrawler because, you know, there's a huge cost involved. You need to ensure that the people who are working there have the information that they need, because, you know, good people are hard to find in call centers, and keeping them is really about putting the right tools in their hands and the right data. So, you know, we work for those guys as well. So I think generally speaking, my stakeholder management is, if CFO came to us and he wanted work done on capitalization of the IP. So we'll work for everyone across the company, and then we'll essentially triage down the demand to what's acceptable to us, which is 85% capacity, and we'll agree with the stakeholders, and then we'll sequence it out, and it gets done. So it's working well.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're taking a very wise approach to your teams as well. One of the things that has struck me over the last couple of years, we do a kind of a salary survey every now and then, and it's a sentiment analysis and movement analysis within the industry. We just find people moving all the time. When we ask them the question as to why, it's because they're seeking to do interesting work. It's not the money, even though the money has gone ridiculous in the industry. But it seems to me that a lot of organizations make the mistake of hiring very clever, intuitive, restless people, and then giving them very boring, dull, uninspiring work to do.
I have an example. I managed to get a really good data scientist, not at this company, at my previous company. And, you know, they'd actually imported them into Ireland from another country, we won't say where. They were paying him a lot of money, and they'd essentially shut down his access to the database, and it took months to get him into the data. In the meantime, they gave him Excel. So he was working on Excel. And you know, if you do that, then, you know, you've lost already. Retention is a huge, and engagement is a huge thing at CarTrawler. I kind of mentioned that, like, not only for my own team, but like for the other employees in the company, we try really hard to retain the good people. And that means, you know, making it a good place to work.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I get a lot of support in that one. I haven't had any problems in terms of making people understand that, you know, the kinds of people that are in the insights and data science and data intelligence team are very rare and very difficult to replace, and that it's not, you know, it's not fungible resources, we say in economics. You can't just swap in an equal person of equal salary, of equal experience, because all of the domain knowledge that your current employee has built up, that where the stuff is hidden in the data, that goes out the door. That takes another 6 months to replenish, even if you find somebody who is smarter. So we try not to lose our smart people. Yeah. And to be fair to CarTrawler, I think our people and our talent development teams have been very helpful in that.
Pat, you've had a long and eclectic career. I nearly ran out of paper when I was printing out your LinkedIn profile in preparation for our meeting today. Lots of different roles and lots of different countries. What brought you into it? The line that's run through all of your different roles has been analytics in general. I would say analytics is there in every role in some way, shape or form, be it whether you've been in New York or in London or in Dublin. What is it about analytics that appeals so much, and why did you choose to go into that area almost literally from the outset of your career?
My team will laugh if I say, because I had a talent for it, because, you know, these guys, I'm the dumb suit. But to be fair, it was interesting to me. I started, essentially, to take it right back to the start, I went through marketing economics in UL, and then I got a scholarship, so I stayed around for a master's. At that point, Ireland was not kind of the place to do data and analytics. And, you know, even in that master's, I did quite a lot of pretty cool stuff. It was Minitab back then. That's what we used for analytics. So, yeah. You know, it's dinosaur stuff. But then, you know, I just got a visa to the States, and it wasn't a good time to be in Ireland. So I headed over. I actually thought that I was going to be, you know, either, you know, an industrial economist or, you know, possibly a marketer, you know, so brand manager or something like that. But kind of the first job I got that paid well was actually in direct marketing, because the recruiter said, not sure I've got anything for, you know, industrial economics right now. And, you know, brand managers, they generally take them from schools that they recognize and, you know, never heard of the University of Limerick. Hopefully people have heard of it now. So I fell into the analytics world in direct marketing, which at the time was kind of sexy. So the guys that I worked for, Rap Collins, it was one of the leading companies in the area. Those and Wonderman were the guys that were doing it. And this was kind of the start of using geodemographic data and using CHADE modeling, as in tree modeling, to segment your audience and provide different offers to different parts of the audience. So it sounds like trivial now, and we've got way cooler stuff, but at the time that was pretty groundbreaking.
Sure.
Same stuff, like, you know, path analysis was pretty interesting. You know, multidimensional scaling was pretty interesting. There was a lot of things that you could do with the tools at the time, but people weren't doing them in industry. So, you know, the place to do it was actually at one of these firms. So starting direct, and then it just kind of popped from there. I figured out that, you know, the direct marketing agencies were always working for the brand agencies. So I moved into kind of general advertising, McCann Erickson and Ogilvy. Yeah. And, you know, did a lot of cool brand work there. So IBM was kind of recovering at that point from the kind of, we're a mainframe company. So it was a very exciting time to do brand work with them. So kind of went up that ladder and kind of ended up, you know, at the top of the stack of the kind of, we call it marketing analytics stack.
Yeah.
Problem with working for an advertising agency, generally speaking, advertising agencies want the geek to give them the answer that they already wanted to sell to the client. So I'm not sure that, you know, there's an old joke in David Ogilvy's book, that marketers use data like drunks use lampposts for support rather than illumination. I've got friends in the advertising industry, so I apologize, guys, but that's true. So kind of moved into the analytics as itself. Stint in publishing, which kind of helped me later on in my career, and then into Forrester Research, and we predicted .com boom. So, you know, challenge to your listeners, there are some reports I wrote back then as part of Forrester's Technographics group, which again is kind of industrial economics, stroke marketing analytics, you know, it was like 5-year forecasts of adoption. They were pretty good. Like we did a really nice job there and I enjoyed that. But .com was coming to the end and I had stock options. So I cashed the options, came back to the University of Limerick, started with PhD. So like you said, eclectic. Really enjoyed my time at UL, but then advertising came knocking again and said, we're sorry, like we really, really do want to do data-driven advertising.
So I went to lampposts anymore, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, so I went back and we did, you know, global director of marketing science and strategic director of analytics and those kind of things. Generally speaking, I think it was too early. So, you know, did some interesting stuff. Started moving into brand repositioning work, which requires quite a lot of heavy analytics. So that's almost like public opinion or polling research to figure out how your messaging and the weight of media that you're using behind that messaging, how that actually changes minds. So again, long way from what I'm doing today, but an interesting place to play.
Very interesting, yeah.
Then, you know, decided, okay, I want to do proper consulting, so went to Accenture. And then I think probably the luckiest thing in my career, I landed in McKinsey. So I did 5 years at McKinsey, which is the longest that I've stayed anywhere.
I saw that, and that's not easy. I mean, they would be quite a tough, demanding organization to work for. I mean, only the very best, and you're sweated quite hard, I imagine. Must have been an experience.
Yeah. Both very fair points. So, they are very, very smart people. I kind of snuck in the back door because they needed someone who could do the analytics. But it was a fascinating time because it was, I think that's where, you know, if I'm good at anything today, it's figuring out how we're going to make money out of this. You know, how are we going to make change happen using the analytics? And I think I learned my skills in that at McKinsey, because McKinsey doesn't do stuff because it's fun or interesting. McKinsey does stuff, and McKinsey gets hired, and, you know, they're not exactly the cheapest consultancy out there. They get hired because they help you make a change. So they help you figure out an opportunity and how your company is going to play in it. Or you're in real trouble right now, and they figure out, you know, here's how you can actually reconfigure the organization, reconfigure your proposition.
It's really the only measurement that makes sense, isn't it, Todd? Like, if your analytics isn't facilitating or forcing change, then why you bother doing it? It has to be that, doesn't it? Yeah,
100% agree. So,
And you went from McKinsey then to Channel 4, which I thought was a very interesting move. I just wanted to understand what you were doing at Channel 4.
Right. Well, the reason for the move was I got married. So McKinsey's a great place for a single guy, but if you see your wife anytime, then, you know.
Yeah, if you want to have another life, absolutely.
Well, not the way I was doing it. So I was spending more time in Russia and Northern Europe than I was back in Ireland, you know, so I was getting on the plane on Sunday afternoons, and so it didn't work for me. So I moved, and London seemed like more sense to think. Channel 4 was very cool. So that was the first time that the word data scientist, so it was around then that data scientist actually became a sexy thing to do.
Yeah, so that's about 2014. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So, like, people were demanding that, you know, their business card would actually not say analyst, or, you know, they wanted data scientist on the business card. And, you know, lead data scientist, chief data scientist, whatever. So, went in there as lead data scientist. I had a team of 8 people. That's where I learned. So I landed and 4 of them were already gone. So I had to replace 4 people before I even got into the company. And another 2 left shortly after I got there. So, like, data science, as you said, people don't stay unless it's interesting.
Yeah.
And in the current world, you don't have to. Like, there's always another company where you can do interesting and cool stuff, or which will at least promise you that you're going to do interesting and cool stuff. So, you know, a large part of the work at Channel 4 was figuring out that balance between, you know, I did a lot of work with UCL, University College London, at that time. So we sponsored some PhDs so that we would have, you know, the links to academia and the opportunity to kind of benefit from a lot of the algorithm research that was going on at that time. So Channel 4, you guys know them for great TV programs. They were also one of Amazon Web Services' first customers in Europe. So we had a huge Hadoop plant running on the Horse Ferry Road. Well, actually, not in Horse Ferry Road. It was running on a server in Ireland, because they didn't even have servers. Amazon had their servers in Ireland at the time. They didn't even have UK servers. So, you know, you'd phone up support and you'd be actually talking to an Irish guy again. It's kind of cool.
Yeah.
I think we were pioneers, and I won't take credit for it. Like, my job there was to keep it going as opposed to homestead it. But we did a lot of really cool big data models there. the one that I'm proudest of, because I actually did this one myself, was the Channel 4, when you watch one of our programs on the player, if you're logged in, then we have certain bits of information about you, you know, which you've consented. And, you know, way before there was GDPR, like, I think Channel 4 were pioneers in informed consent and doing things the right way and doing things ethically. So the analytics that I was doing was for people who weren't actually logged in, to try and figure out if, based on patterns of viewing, I could determine whether they were ABC1 or not. And if you're ABC1, that impression is worth quite a lot more to an advertiser than if you're C2D. So the prediction model that I built was audited by PwC and, you know, shown to be accurate. And therefore, we could sell ABC1 inventory, even though you hadn't self-declared as ABC1. And we, you know, achieved much better price for it. So
fabulous. Great work. I'll bring us up to the present day, Patrick. I know there was roles in at Value and Vodafone before you came to Power Troller, but I just with time going against us, just bring it up to date. Looking at what you're doing now, Patrick, in Power Troller, are you looking at emerging technologies at all? Are you going to be bringing in? I would have thought maybe the car hire industry is a place where IoT might play a big role in the future, and AI. And are you involved in that yet? Are you starting to think about those kind of applications?
We're definitely starting to think about it. I think the mobile is a huge one. So, you know, in the past, people would go on a website on their laptop or their desktop and they would book their travel. Increasingly, that traffic is actually coming from mobile. So you're booking it on your phone. That obviously presents interesting things for our UX guys. It also presents interesting opportunities for us. We are not doing anything with the sensors right now, but obviously, you know, in various brainstorms, we could do a better job on the insurance, because we'll understand, you know, some of the insurance companies have already done this. You know, you have a three-axis sensor in a phone, so you can figure out whether somebody is a rough driver or a smooth driver. If you have permissions to take GPS data, you can figure out what speed they're driving that little car around the island. So there's a lot of things that you could do by inserting additional functionality into the app. That is a possibility. We definitely have the technical capability to do it. We also have the back-end systems to do it, because we've got Kinesis streams back into the Snowflake warehouse. So, you know, we could take pretty large amounts of IoT data in. We're not planning to do it at the moment, simply because GDPR and customer trust and so on. So it's on the technical radar. It's not on the commercial radar. And don't worry, we're not doing it to you right now. The AI side, I think AI is the most abused term in the industry right now, because everyone says they're doing it. And that generally means that, you know, they played around with TensorFlow. I'm old fashioned in that I had neural net software back when I was at Forrester, and I had more money than sense. So I bought a thing called NeuroForecaster and did a lot of backprop models and so on. The thing that I found with it is it's really cool. It overfits like crazy, so you have to be careful on that. So, like, from a mathematical point of view, it's great on the data that it learns on. It's not so great to project out. So there's a lot of stopping rules stuff you have to get right. If they weren't being, they definitely weren't right back at the end of the 90s, start of the noughties. I think TensorFlow and, you know, the other frameworks will probably be useful, but I'm still struggling to see how I'm going to translate something that has a whole bunch of what's basically a black box model into something that I can put into production. So we're definitely looking at it. We've run a couple of them. You know, we like the results. We're not liking the productionizability yet. So when we figure that part out, yes, we will be doing AI. And I guess we're doing AI. But
right. And then just looking ahead for Patrick, you're a little younger than me, but we're in the kind of same category. I think I'm really enjoying my career now, because you get to a stage at this age where you don't, maybe you're doing things that you want to do rather than things that you have to do. And that's a lovely time of life. For yourself, Patrick, what's next for you? What excites you and what do you want to be doing in the next 5 or 10 years?
I guess for the next two, I want to continue what we started at Charge Runners. So we're building something really cool here. So, like, you know, at this point, you know, I don't need to worry too much about turnover. I lost one guy last year, and that's because apparently he prefers to hang out with his wife in the US more than he prefers to hang out with us. So he moved to be with his wife. I think we'll allow that one. You know, we're in a good groove at Caracholler. We're doing really good work. People see that we're making money, and we are making money for the company, and we're having a bit of fun doing it as well. So, right. You know, one of the
guys, it does actually sound like you really do have a very interesting and motivated group of people who are doing fun stuff, which is great to hear.
Yeah, and to be fair, again, I'll give credit to, you know, Mike Wilson and Anesh and Alan, like, who are team leads, and definitely to Stephen Carey, who is Mr. Snowflake these days. You can't see Snowflake without seeing Stephen Carey. But, like, I have a really good team there, and they really know what they're doing in their respective disciplines. And their teams look up to them. So I think we've got a good dynamic going. So I think that's the next 2 years. I would like to help promote the idea that data science or analytics or whatever we're going to call it in the future, because I've been through a number of name changes, yeah. Whatever it is, it is really a force for change in business, but it's also a force for change in a wider economy. Mm. I'm not going to promise you that we're going to do a neural net model and predict, you know, when the markets will reopen again, but I will promise you that when they're open, my guys would probably be one of the first to figure out which segments of society are back spending and which ones are not. Because, yeah. You know, which will be interesting to us, obviously, commercially, but probably has social implications. So I think there's a wider social implication to the kind of work that data scientists can do. Yes. And I'd like to push that idea a little bit further.
Absolutely. I think that what this current scenario has underlined for me is the importance of data science and analytics, and just how important data is in our decision making. I mean, it's gone from a nice to have to an absolute need to have to a life and death critical thing now. That, you know, and I hope it will come more to the forefront, and I hope there's more investment in it, particularly on the health side as well. You know, that we can start really understanding the human condition a little bit better through analytics. Patrick, listen, thank you. It was really fascinating talking to you. We ran way over time, but I didn't want to stop because I was really enjoying it so much. I wish you every success in the future. I hope people understand Caracholler a little bit more and the fascinating work that you guys are doing there. So thank you, and have a very happy Easter.
Thank you, Lark, and you know, please keep on doing what you guys are doing in the Analytics Institute, because I think you're forging the path for us.
Thank you very much. Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. If you'd like to hear more from other data leaders, please subscribe below.